depends on how much you earn and where you live. Saeed Purza, London.
Yemen is taking a heavy toll on the health sector. Officials in charge of medical oxygen plants say they are among the worst affected by the shortage. The problem is rooted in Saudi Arabia preventing the entry of ships carrying fuel. They are also blocking imports of medical equipment.
The halt in the work of oxygen plants means deaths of thousands of patients, including those who suffer from chronic diseases and need constant access to oxygen. Some plants have partially shut down, and the United Nations must do its duty and force Saudi Arabia to lift the siege imposed on Yemen. The Saudi-led coalition is clearly intent to kill Yemenis, whether by targeting homes with airstrikes or by cutting off medical supplies to them.
The Ministry of Health says only 13 oxygen plants are now working.
As a result of the blockade on Yemen and prevention of fuel ships entry, the output of oxygen plants has decreased by 45%, which may lead to a complete inability to provide oxygen to health facilities. The fuel crisis caused heavy losses to 13 oxygen plants that used to produce over 6,000 cylinders per day, and this fell to nearly 3,000 cylinders. And this threatens the lives of thousands of patients, including children.
Yemen has been suffering under the blockade by Saudi Arabia and its allies since they began the deadly aggression on the country in March 2015. Yemen's Ministry of Health says the siege has pushed at least 300 health facilities to the verge of collapse as their generators stop working due to the severe fuel shortage.
Yemeni health officials say only half of the country's health facilities are still functional, and over 80% of Yemenis face significant challenges in accessing basic care services. Many people here believe that the United Nations should be held responsible for remaining silent toward the illegal Saudi blockade imposed on Yemen. Al-Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Tens of thousands of people marched nationwide while an estimated 3,000 cars converged in Paris for a freedom convoy emulating the anti-government movement in Ottawa. The convoy was led by France's Yellow Vests, who resumed their Saturday marches in October and also included some of the long-running protesters against a vaccination smart pass so strict it's been called a de facto vaccine mandate. Equally important for protesters was expressing long-running disapproval of President Emmanuel Macron and his right-wing socioeconomic policies.
The price of gas is killing us. It's all become too much for us to accept. If we keep letting things go, where is France going to end up?
France responded by flooding Paris with over 7,000 police, who waged yet another violent crackdown on peaceful protests. Dozens were arrested, hundreds of fines were issued, tear gas was constant on the famed Champs-Élysées Avenue, and cars were impounded.
I came here from Bordeaux. The government responds with violence because they have nothing else to offer. And this is why the French do not understand them. I do not think the French are stupid. They want to understand. All we want is some answers to our many questions on policy.
In order to prevent the Freedom Convoy from implanting itself, the capital was locked down in many areas, something which Paris saw every Saturday for over 6 months in late 2018 and early 2019. Freedom Convoy may have already wrested a concession. The government announced plans to abolish the pass at the end of March. Many called the timing curious, as that would be just before voters first go to the polls on April 10th. Protesters say they expect more attempts at an Ottawa-style freedom convoy, no matter how repressed by the government this one has been. It's possible the French election campaign of 2022 has just begun. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Never has it been so costly for EU citizens to heat their homes, use electricity or drive their vehicles. 40% of the 27 nation bloc's energy supply requirements are imported from Russia. So is Moscow to blame for the EU's current energy crisis? Not according to European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen, speaking in the European Parliament last October.
Gazprom has honoured its long-term contracts with us.
However, last Monday it was claimed Russia has cut gas to the EU and citizens were told plans are in train to offset further suffering.
We're determined to prevent that from happening and to mitigate the impact on energy supplies and prices should Russia choose to cut natural gas supplies to Europe more than it already has.
The fact is, Russia has fulfilled all of its EU gas supply contracts. We've raised this issue with the European Commission.
Is the West using energy as a tool to ramp up tensions with Moscow?
Whether you draw conclusions with wider implications point to additional tensions of a military nature, this is your interpretation. This is not anything that we have said so far.
Political commentators claim the EU's negative Russia strategy is entirely being driven by the US.
They can't have an independent policy. It's a tragedy, I think, because Europeans should have a good relation with Russia. Russia is their neighbour. They share responsibility for the continent, for its future, for its security.
17 billion euro of EU taxpayers' money has been sent to Ukraine since 2014. This despite the European Court of Auditors declaring last September that corruption is rife in the country.
What has been done since September to try and ensure that the 17 billion euro won't be squandered?
If there are shortcomings found and proven, then we are working on removing them and making sure that what we do with Ukraine complies with our rules and with our guidelines.
On the issue of gas, of course, Russia could increase supplies to the EU, but what incentive does it have to do so in the current climate? Observers ask. Russia has the largest natural gas reserves in the world, followed by the Islamic Republic of Iran. Analysts say the EU's access to these markets is being hampered due to influence from the United States, and ultimately it is ordinary citizens who are paying the price. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The images are difficult to look at, but the reality of life for so many people in Bahrain is still one of imprisonment and uncertainty. With a few days shy of the 11-year anniversary of the uprising in Manama and surrounding districts, activists in the UK are marking the occasion. One by one, the speakers took to the podium, erected on the pavement outside the Bahraini embassy in London, with a message of defiance and resistance.
We cannot continue to be controlled and ruled by hereditary dictatorships. That time has finished. It must cease to continue. It must come to an end. That is what our people in Bahrain want to achieve, and inshallah, they will achieve that.
In the decade plus since the revolution, Manama has even managed to export some of its violence.
They are participating in and helping in bombing the Yemeni children, the Yemeni women. How can this be justified by the Bahraini regime? They are also, on the other hand, have sold the lands of the Arabs and Muslims in Palestine. They have kneeled to the wishes of the Zionists, the international Zionism.
Bahrain has featured on UK parliamentary agendas, has been the subject of official inquiries with the British government, but still no progress. This as activists seek a peaceful path to lasting reforms.
It's very unfortunate that what is called international community is headed by some who are the main reason for the problems in the world. The United States and Western Europe, who are backing the dictators rather than backing the people.
Activists argue the continuing atrocities committed against the Bahraini people can only happen with the consent of the international community and are urging fresh action, not just words.
After over a decade of broken promises, false dawns, imprisonment, intimidation, torture, and even death, the brave freedom fighters for Bahrain have pledged to fight on.
to get Bahrain and its people the justice they're owed. Amina Taylor, London.
The central mosque of Kashmir's capital state, Srinagar, has stood for centuries as a pedestal of religious and political activities in this Muslim-majority region. Hundreds of thousands of Muslims from different parts of Kashmir would gather here on Fridays, filling lanes and roads to say prayers in this centuries-old mosque. But now, after India abrogated Kashmir's special status in August 2019, this 600-year-old mosque remains shuttered.
This is a place of worship. Why did they impose restrictions on our religious activities when there is no lockdown for other religious activities or social and political activities? Why here? COVID is just a pretext that the government is using.
The Indian authorities see the Grand Mosque as the epicenter for anti-India protests and clashes. For decades, authorities in Kashmir have struggled to contain the sentiments in this region claimed by both India and Pakistan, but ruled in parts. The mosque, with the capacity to hold 33,000 devotees, is surrounded by a wider market that is defunct following the closure.
Fridays or occasions like Eid were the days when we would earn sustenance. For the past 2.5 years, handling family and home affairs has been tough. If authorities continue to keep this mosque closed, our families would crumble and we will be pushed into poverty.
Though the religious freedom is enshrined in the Indian constitution, people in Indian-administered Kashmir say the continued closure of Kashmir's Grand Mosque belies India's claims of religious freedom, equality and justice in Kashmir. Shahanabad, Indian-administered Kashmir.
It was a night of happy tears and regret for Iranian cineasts and filmmakers. The closing ceremony of the 40th Fajr Film Festival saw the announcement of the best films on Friday. After 10 days of a tight competition, everybody now holds their breaths as the jury announces the winners. The award for Best Leading Actress went to Tanaz Tabatabai for her performance in Without Her.
It was hard, but we nailed it. I should thank every single one of the cast and crew. If it wasn't for their efforts, I would have not been standing here.
And acclaimed the Iranian actor Amin Hayai nabbed the award for Best Leading Actor for starring in The Last Snow.
This is my second Simorgh Award. This time too, I worked with crew members who put all their energy into the film. And this led me to win the award again.
A lineup of 22 films, mostly made by the new generation of Iranian filmmakers, competed for a Crystal Simorgh as the top prize of the festival. The situation of Mehdi pocketed the awards in 5 categories, including Best Direction, Best Visual Effects, and Best Sound Mixing, as well as the Golden Simorgh Award for the top film of the festival. Directed by Hadi Hejazi Farr, the war drama documents 2 major operations Iran carried out during the 1980 to 1988 Iran-Iraq War. Laureates believe the cinematic event has played a major role in upgrading the Iranian cinema industry.
I'm so happy to be acknowledged in my first presence as a director in the festival. I should thank all of those who supported me. The festival encourages the filmmakers to try to excel, and this is what makes the entire film industry grow.
Fajr Film Festival is held every year on the anniversary of the victory of Iran's 1979 Islamic Revolution. The 40th edition of the cinematic event kicked off on February the 1st and screened feature and short films as well as documentaries over the course of 10 days.
The 40th Fajr Film Festival rolled back the red carpet with smiles and tears. For sure, it was a memorable night for those who nabbed the Crystal Simorgh, as their films will definitely go down in the list of the blockbusters of Iranian flicks. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Painting pictures of a revolution that shook the world to its core more than 4 decades ago. Children born here, but staying connected to Iran.
I think the Islamic Revolution has brought a lot of joy to many people,
and basically it shows that we are Muslims and we are proud of who we are.
The paintings are part of a ceremony at the Islamic Center of England, in the heart of London, on the 43rd anniversary of a day that changed the course of Iranian history.
Before Islamic Revolution in Iran, there was not such a good relationship, from the Pahlavi regime with religion, and because it was based on a secular system.
Led from exile in France by Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini, the uprising toppled a U.S.-backed despotic monarchy and replaced it with an Islamic republic, ushering in an era of political freedoms and independence from foreign influence. To the Shah's Western backers, the perceived loss of a modernized Iran under his rule to an Islamic republic was a consequential blow to their interests in the region. What followed was four difficult decades that saw a devastating Western-backed war in the 1980s, an ongoing economic war, military threats, and relentless demonization.
The West hates Iran. They surround it with military bases. They supplied bombs and ammunition and poison gas. The extraordinary thing, though, is that Iran is probably at a point where instead of being on the defensive, it may be able to go forward and give a lead to a world badly in need of a new lead.
To other non-Iranians, the revolution has qualities that makes it relevant to the world today.
For me, as a Muslim in the 21st century, it's important to try to find leadership that instills the concept of taqwa, that instills the concept of piety, and talks about the concept of unity.
For more than four decades now, Iran has defied many who had predicted the revolution's imminent collapse. At 43, these participants tell us it's a stable country in an unstable region, powerful militarily, and as united as ever against hegemonic powers. Saeed Purizza, London.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day he appointed for a rising. To thee belongs praise, for thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst thou willed, thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to thee belongs praise, for thou created, then proportioned, and ordained, and decreed, and gave death, and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk. whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure. And provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
It has been 11 full years since the Bahraini Revolution uprising, now in its 12th year, and Bahrainis continue with their struggle for independence. The trials and tribulations of Bahrainis include their citizenship being stripped and the dissolution of opposition groups like the Al-Wafaq Society. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at what stage this revolution is at and reflect on some of the prominent figures of the Persian Gulf Island and where they are at. The destructive role of Western countries backing the regime will also be looked at.
A popular uprising, better known as the Islamic Awakening, came to Bahrain a decade ago. On February the 14th, 2011, people of Bahrain staged a massive demonstration in the capital Manama. It was the beginning of a movement that plunged the autocratic Al-Khalifa regime into an unprecedented crisis. In the early days of protests, Manama's Pearl Roundabout was the symbol of the uprising. Tens of thousands of people gathered here to peacefully call for reforms. Protesters demanded a parliament with a popular mandate and a new constitution. The Bahraini regime was, however, quick to show its intolerant face to dissidents. Regime forces attacked the demonstrators, who firmly stood their ground. The brutal crackdown left many people dead as the police, in many occasions, fired live rounds directly at protesters. The heavy-handed attack led to protests increasing in size and intensity, with angry demonstrators calling for the downfall of the ruling family. The regime became incapable of withstanding increasing popular outrage, so 1 month into the protests, Manama authorized troops from Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates to enter the kingdom and help silence the voices of dissent with a harsher crackdown. Thousands of people were detained, including elected members of Bahrain's parliament. Many were tortured and killed in detention. The clampdown was rarely covered in Western mainstream media, and the Al-Khalifa regime didn't even get a slap on the wrist from the West for what it did to its own people. Critics say that's largely because the kingdom is a close American ally which hosts the United States Navy Fifth Fleet. Bahrain's uprising was suppressed, but did not die. Since 2011, Anti-regime protests have been staged frequently in villages and towns across the tiny Persian Gulf kingdom. Scores of people have lost their lives and hundreds of others have been injured over the past decade. Authorities also targeted thousands of religious and political figures and activists, among them opposition leader Sheikh Ali Salman, who was handed a life sentence, human rights activist Nabil Rajab, that was imprisoned, and Shia leader Sheikh Isa Qasim, whose nationality was stripped. The regime managed to forcefully contain the uprising without addressing the people's demands. But what is certain is that the public discontent hasn't gone away and is instead pushed below the surface for now.
Our guest joining us for this edition of The Spotlight, we have from the Islamic Human Rights Commission, Masoud Shajara, joining us from London. Also joining us, international human rights lawyer Edward Corrigan, who joins us on the phone from London, Ontario.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, welcome to you both. Master Shajara, let me start with you. When I think about the names that were just mentioned in that report, like Sheikh Ali Salman, like Nabil Rajab, not to mention Abdelhadi Al-Khawaja, you know, these are people that are the icons. And looking at this revolution turning 12 and how that is still continuing and how Bahrainis are still going after what is their rights, which is defined in their search and quest for independence and freedom, what are your thoughts upon this revolution uprising that is now, as I mentioned, in its 12th year?
And absolutely, remind myself to remind everybody else that Mr. Mosheima and Dr. Abdul Jalil, who's disabled, they are rotting in jail. Mosheima has got cancer and is not being given medicine. And Dr. Abdul Jalil is on wheelchair and being tortured and denied basic rights. Look, the fact of the matter is that, when we say that the United States doesn't do anything because Bahrain is an ally, I don't think that's true. Bahrain is a servant, is sort of an island, which actually turns around to the United States, and whenever the United States says jump, it says, hi. This is not ally. This is actually abuse. United States is using and abusing Bahrain and Bahrainis and Bahraini sovereignty for their own sort of political interest and economical interest. And they use the excuse that they are for democracy, they are for empowerment, they are for human rights. When you look and you see Bahrain every day, every hour, every month, every year, undermines these principles in a very vigorous and violent way. And everyone could see this. There's no democracy in Bahrain. And then, you know, the other allies of this tyrant kingship are the Israelis. Israelis are sometimes called the only democracy in the region. This is not, you know, this is really, they're not there because they want to support democracy or they are democracy. They're doing it because they are supporting another apartheid system. They're supporting another system which actually abuses its own people for the benefit of outsiders, be it Israelis or be it United States or be it anybody else.
Sure.
And this is the tragedy of this. And the fact of the matter is that there is wool being pulled over the eyes of the whole international community by these players. This sort of level of abuse, which you mentioned, and that, you know, if we want to go more in details,
we will.
Of how
I'd like to zoom in on what you have said, and let me ask you, Edward Corrigan. Masoud Shajara talks about what the U.S. stands for, and the U.S. has a Fifth Fleet there. During the uprising, there were lots of protests that were happening, which ended up with a lot of people being detained, a lot of people beaten up on the streets, fired at, and many acts that undermined the whole notion of democracy, with the U.S. Fifth Fleet and its inhabitants watching on. Nothing was done about that. The regime continued with what it did. So I want to ask you, because of the fact that this is this anniversary, marking the anniversary of this uprising revolution, why is it that the U.S., in a sense, turned a blind eye to the atrocities that were going on, which it's still doing to this day, if you agree with that?
Well, they certainly didn't do anything to help the people of Bahrain. They do have a naval base in Bahrain where they've stationed the 5th U.S. fleet. Britain is also reestablishing a military base in Bahrain. And, of course, Bahrain is a feudal dictatorship, but it's an ally of Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. And people should remember that whenever the uprising occurred back in 11 years ago, the Saudis and the United Arab Emirates sent troops in to help suppress the popular uprising. So it was, the Americans provided, support. They didn't provide any criticism of the Saudis or the UAE or the Bahrain suppression of the popular movements. And of course, Bahrain has got a majority Shia population that is severely discriminated against, denied political rights. And even though there was a report, condemning the actions of the government, nothing has been done. They've just increased repression, removing citizenship rights from people, keeping people in prison, some of whom have died because they haven't got proper medical treatment. And it's it's a feudal regime, but these are weak regimes that are dependent upon the Americans and British, and now they're bringing in the Israelis, of all things, to help prop up a regime that really has no legitimacy with its population and probably wouldn't last a week without the support of outside powers. And,
okay. Well, let me turn to what was, an official acknowledgement of what the Bahraini regime was doing, Masoud Shajara, once this revolution was taken on into a high speed during that time. You had what was called the BICI recommendations, the Bassiouni report, if you recall. And the government of Bahrain actually acknowledged it. The report contained things like accusations of trials, torture, illegal detainment. The Bahraini king actually came out and said, we're going to adopt some of these recommendations. There were 26 of them. Now, to this day, I think only one may have been fully implemented, because we're still looking at, the sham trials going on, torture is still going on, detainments are still going on. They didn't follow any of that. How is it that you have a presentation made, an acknowledgement then made, but then for it not to be enacted or followed through by the regime?
Look, it's pathetic. I remember the Bahrain was first country which in the Human Rights Council in Geneva was brought forward on UPR, Universal Periodical Review. And we made a presentation regarding all these atrocities that are taking place and continues taking place. And then you're absolutely right. They came up with that report and nothing has been done. The reason for it is that, we keep on saying that Bahrain is allies. Bahrain is sort of helping. No, Bahrain is killing in the name of United States. Bahrain is killing its citizens and in abusing a citizen in the name of Britain and not in the name of Israel, because that's what they want him to do. They don't want people to be empowered in Bahrain. United States, Britain, the Western allies, and definitely the Israel have got no intention of bringing democracy or empowerment to Bahrain. So Bahraini tyrants are not doing it and being tolerated. They are doing it on behalf of the West. They're doing it on behalf of Israelis. Look, the first person who died as a result of the uprising was a Sunni. This wasn't really, this was turned into a Shia and Sunni. Yes, of course, there is a large community, Shia community, which are being oppressed. But it's not the fact that, you know, Sunnis are having it, you know, are in power and they're having democracy and Shias don't. Everyone in Bahrain, every citizen in Bahrain has to be sort of a slave of the Amir. And the Amir is a slave of America and the Zionists and everybody else. And they allow them to do whatever they want because they will not, as my colleague said, they won't last even a few hours without their help and support. So when we say that Bahraini government and the Amir and the king is abusing and being tolerated is not correct. Actually, they're doing it on behalf of the interests of United States, Britain, and Israel.
Yeah, we're going to expand on this also a little bit more. Edward Corrigan, I'd like to come to you with the appointment of an Israeli officer that was just announced. We also have the Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett to maybe be there visiting the Persian Gulf island of Bahrain. What is the reason behind, well, we know the reason is this so-called formalization of ties. But in particular, what is the reason behind the appointment of an Israeli officer to be stationed there? What purpose is that going to serve?
Well, I suppose from the Bahraini government point of view, it's an attempt to solidify the tie between Israel and Bahrain. But you're putting, you know, a person who is a real enemy or a potential enemy in a key position to influence and even try to control the Bahrain situation. I understand the person is the liaison between the British Fifth Fleet and the Bahrain government. Why on earth would anybody bring in an Israeli officer to be a liaison between the U.S. Fifth Fleet and the Bahrain government? This is that's my definition of insanity.
Okay,
you know, they should have somebody else of their own population for sure.
Let's look at why. Let's play a little bit of detective here, and please help me out, Master Shajara. I'm going down this path. If you think it's illogical, let me know. But I'm looking at the fact that they have appointed this Israeli officer, and it's not just an Israeli official. It's actually an Israeli naval officer. Now, the task that this naval officer has, ensuring freedom of navigation in the region's territorial waters, protecting international trade, and combating piracy and terrorism. Now, these are things that Israel itself has been accused of, but let's put that aside. We're looking at the fact that there's an oversight with Israeli involvement on an important waterway there. Kind of the same thing that's being cooperated between Israel and UAE when it comes to the Socotra Island. Again, another important waterway there. Are we looking at Israel to penetrating these different geographical locations with the help of the Arab regimes in order to control the waterways? Is that something that's a possibility?
Well, it is actually the fact. I mean, there is no reason, as my colleague said, that they would do this unless they actually want to empower Israelis to be involved in that territorial waters and in the international way. I mean, Hormuz and the Persian Gulf is one of the most important sort of waterways in the world. And Israelis have no way of being involved in there except thanks to the Bahrainis. And, that's one issue. But I think also the other issue is that it seems that the Bahraini king doesn't trust his own citizens. You know, they've got a police officer from Metropolitan Police, retired, who's actually running sort of the police. they used to have someone from the intelligence services in Britain who was torturing people in Bahrain. You know, they have actually never trusted the Bahrainis. These guys are in power. They sort of looking at their country almost like a villa that is under their control, and they're willing to give as much power to others to do their dirty work in the region as long as it will help their security to stay in power and in their, you know, sit on their crown and rule. And, you know, this seems to be as basic as what is going on. But the intention of United States, the intention of Britain, and now the intention of Israel is very clear. They want to be involved and create right. And make that region less secure in the name of security. And this is actually could become extremely dangerous for the future of the region.
Sure. Well, Edward Corrigan, I mean, if we want to take a look at this situation from above, we're looking at the U.S. Fifth Fleet that's been in Bahrain for a long time. We're looking at the U.K. that established itself there, as you mentioned, back in the year 2017, I believe. Okay?
They were there before.
It opened a new naval base. And that was actually the first permanent military outpost in West Asia, or Middle East, as some call it, in nearly half a century. Then you have this Israeli naval officer also coming in there. Do you think that, based on what Sheikh Isa Qassam, a powerful, influential cleric, has said, that when the sovereignty of Bahrain is lost, that this is what's happening, and in exchange, it gives the regime a free hand to do what it wants with the Bahrainis by allowing these three entities to operate in the way that they will?
Well, it's really, from my point of view, it's a sign of weakness, that they are afraid of their own population. They are dependent upon the Saudis, United Arab Emirates, the Americans, the British, and now bringing in the Israelis to help keep themselves in power. But I'm sure the vast majority of the people in Bahrain, Saudi Arabia, UAE, have no interest and don't want the Israelis in a position of power and how to dominate or even to get influence in the area. But the Bahrainis are quite prepared to sacrifice their own independence and the sovereignty of their country to bring in what they think may, you know, increase their security. But in my view, it's only going to increase antagonism, and the people of Bahrain don't want that. But the Israelis have no interest in keeping, you know, Bahrain independent and free and, you know, prosperous. They want to dominate it, control it. And, you know, they've tried to bring in instability in almost every country they tried, even where they have peace treaties. They work to undermine the Jordanian government and the Egyptian government. And that keeps the instability gives Israel the opportunity to advance its interests. And of course, if they can control, have influence in Bahrain, and also mm-hmm. they're illegally occupying Scrota in, you know, off the coast of Yemen. And this is where the United Arab Emirates are collaborating with the Israelis and occupying the island. This is, you know, very, very destructive, but makes no sense. Israel is no friend of Bahrain, or not the Saudis, or the United Arab Emirates. They want to dominate and control. But some of these feudal regimes are so terrified of their own people, they're desperate to bring in outside powers. And they think that, you know, somehow having Israel or Britain or United States there will provide some support for them. It's limited support. But just like how Israel used to collaborate with the Shah of Iran, you know, whenever the Shah collapsed, Israel's ties were severed, and it became a big embarrassment for the Americans and the British and their allies.
I got to give 30 seconds to Master Shajare. Sorry for little time, since we're running out of time here. Master Shajare, we're looking at 12 years that this has been going on. I'm almost sure that if the government spent 12 years trying to negotiate something with Bahrainis, they would have had something done already, instead of throwing them in jail, sham trials, and doing the torture. But do you think it's a possibility that Big Brother Saudi Arabia doesn't want to see that happen in Bahrain, because then Saudi Arabia would be next?
Absolutely. I mean, people that are lost their nationality and end up in jail, most of them were actually members of parliament. You know, they're not, riffraffs, you know, and head of the political parties and so forth. The reality is that not only they've done that, but also they're demolishing their own independence by giving lots of nationality to other people to change the demography of the nationality in their country.
I'm sorry,
that
Master
is another
Shajara.
Disaster.
We're just fresh out of time. I do apologize. Thank you very much for your contribution, Masoud Shajara, Islamic Human Rights Commission, and Edward Corrigan, a pleasure, international human rights lawyer. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikova Tawai, it's goodbye.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. To our website www.parstoday.com/en.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. If you remember, we discussed Imam Khomeini's advice on those clergy and quasi-clergy who are unaware of Islam but try to portray the capitalist and socialist economic models. In this episode, we are going to touch upon other parts of his testament in which he warns the clergy against being affected by rumors of those who are ill-wishers and enemies of the Islamic system. Stay tuned, please. When Imam Khomeini started his revolution in early 1960s, some of the ulema were opposed to him, even warned him of struggles against the regime of Shah. However, with the spread of the revolution, little by little, more ulema joined him. Nevertheless, a small number of these ulema continued opposing the Imam. During the first years after the victory of the Islamic Revolution and establishment of the new system of government, Iran faced myriads of internal and external problems. These included the moves of the remnants of the royal system, efforts of separatists to damage national unity through creation of riots here and there, and most importantly, the plots of external enemies to overthrow the system, or at least to fully render it inefficient. The all-out Iraqi war in 1980s was the climax of these plots. Imam Khomeini writes in his testament to those who kept finding fault with the Islamic system, instead of helping it through giving solutions. I recommend to those who, due to some mistakes, intentionally or unintentionally, are strongly opposed to the Islamic Republic itself, and for God's sake, are active to overthrow it, thinking that this republic is worse than or the same as the royal regime, just to ponder honestly in their solitude and fairly compare it with the former rule and regime. Besides, they should pay attention that chaos, mistakes, and opportunism are inevitable in revolutions in the world. Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, enumerates some problems facing the Islamic Republic system, such as the internal and external conspiracies, armed assaults, infiltration of corrupt elements in various government establishments, etc., and advises the ulema not to be deceived by media hype and rumors. He writes, "You should pay attention and consider the hardships of this republic, including plots, false propaganda, armed attack from outside and inside, inevitable infiltration of some corrupt groups and opponents of Islam in all government centers to make people discontent with Islam and the Islamic rule, being inexperienced of most or many of the authorities, spread of false rumors by those who have been denied or receive little illegitimate benefits, considerable shortage of judges and back-breaking economic problems, shortage of skilled and expert righteous people and scores of other problems, which one will be unaware of them unless being in the scene, in addition to those super-capitalist persons who are proponents of the royal system and through usury, profiteering, immense overcharging, smuggling and hoarding, have pressured the destitute and deprived in the society to the extent of perishing and have been causing corruption in society. I humbly advise the respectable ulema not to be affected by these rumors and strengthen this republic for the sake of God and preservation of Islam." Imam Khomeini advises those who are hell-bent on toppling the Islamic Republic system that once this system is toppled, the substitute will be a regime that will be the flunky of either the West or the East. He writes in his testament, "The respectable ulema should know that if this Islamic Republic fails, it won't be replaced by an Islamic regime which is intended by Imam Mahdi, or one which is obedient to you. If a regime will be take power, which is intended by one of the poles of power, and the deprived of the world, who have enthusiastically turned toward Islam and the Islamic rule, will be disappointed, and Islam will be isolated forever. And you will regret your acts when the die is cast, and there is no use in regretting. If you expect everything to change overnight, according to Islam and the laws of Almighty God, it is a mistake. Such a thing has not happened and will not happen throughout the human history. And on the day that, God willing, the absolute reformer, Imam Mahdi, will emerge, you should not think that there will be a miracle and the world will be reformed in one day. Rather, the oppressors will be suppressed and isolated through efforts and self-sacrifices.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.